Well, that's deuce is wild. That's subjective, right? Right? And so you start to come up with creative, right, interpretations of
the
text.
Pushing the boundaries.
And there are not these constraints. So literature studies are going to go in a certain direction. Frank Lentricchio was a colleague of Fish's while he was at Duke. Duke's university is very important, right, to this postmodern story. And there's a fork in the road here, because for some postmodernists, it's just a matter of being playful and interesting and coming up with cool interpretations that push your value buttons, the Fish option. But we also know that postmodernism has an agenda. Right? There is a politics, right, at work, and this is what Lentricchia is going to argue here. He says, postmodernism, this is now old news, seeks not to find the foundation and the conditions of truth. All right. So we're not interested in about the conditions of truth. Right? That's what Foucault told us we don't do anymore. Rorty, right, agrees. Well, if we're not about truth, then what are we about? We are about exercising power for the purpose of social change. Truth is out. Power is in. And then he immediately applies this to the education, because he's a professor, he has students, right, coming in on a regular basis. What should I be doing, right, as a professor? Well, the entire ideal of liberal arts education, right, is based on the Enlightenment vision. Every human being, including these young people who come into my classes, have the capacity for reasoning. And I have to expose them to the facts, lots of different experiences, and have lots of debates and discussions, right, among the students and with me about the different ways we might interpret, right, all of these facts and data. And we're going to put our interpretations up against the really smart people who've written the books that everybody, right, the other smart people think that we should read. And the idea is we are training the individual human being's capacity for thinking, for digesting their experience, for being open to new experience, to debate, changing their mind on all of the rhetoric and argument and so forth. That's what your job is as a professor, because that's what you think is the best way students can become truth seekers themselves and really come up with the kind of knowledge that they can rely on in their lives. But if all of that is out, what's left is power. My job as a professor, as he goes on to say, is to, quote, help students spot, confront, and work against the political horrors of one's time. So John Gray is right. We do live in the dim ruins of the enlightened world. It's all crap right out there. My job as a professor is to train activists. And I use my power to do that. Recasting, right, of education on postmodern line. Andrea Dworkin, right? Not generic. We know that postmodernism comes in sub-brands, right? There are racial versions, there are feminist versions, there are environmentalist versions, there are ethnic versions, there are religiously based versions, right, and so forth. The Enlightenment said, right, every individual matters. All human beings should, right, be free to explore their own lives intellectually, politically, economically, and people should have certain rights and so forth. And so we strive for the extension of those liberties to all human beings. Everybody should ultimately be equal, and then we'll be, right, peaceful and progressive. Dworkin, right, in her postmodern phase, right, in a book called Intercourse. You don't want to read it, really, despite the...
I'll leave it there. You ever heard that all marital sex is rape? She's the one that started that. She's the one that put that idea out there. And this is when the pushing the boundaries. The culture of fakes with respect to art is all about pushing the boundaries. So we have a crucifix in a jar of urine, a picture of the Madonna made out of elephant dung. Remember the Andy Warhol just painting a picture of Campbell's soup, and that's supposed to be art. Or on the other end, you just throw buckets of paint on a canvas, and that's art, and it sells for $1 million. And it's all about pushing those values, boundaries, further and further until we are 4 generations now where we're at today. This is the challenge to the church. That these students who are going through these universities, they're almost all the same, there are certain curriculums that are more specified, but even in the most scientific curriculums, you have the humanities section and required reading and all of that kind of stuff. It's all geared, all of that literature is for the reshaping of the mind. And one of those foundations is that there is no truth. And so presuppositionally, we can backstep down through this, that it's atheistic. All postmoderns, and he talks about that. He does not, if it's sort of a random, that they should be spread across a wide range of political and philosophical ideas, but they're not. They're almost exclusively leftist and atheistic. Very, very few exceptions. And so it's a momentum being pushed in a certain direction in this culture.
The thing that has helped me anyway, thinking about these kinds of things, is to remember that our battle isn't against flesh and blood, but against these spiritual powers and principalities and these cosmic forces. Very often these activist type, progressive college people, I think really think they're doing a good thing, and they're not like nefariously trying to think through and think, okay, I'm gonna.
How bad can we make it?
Right. But they're duped and used by the deceiver, yes, the father of lies, to push this thing, I think, completely unbeknownst to them. And so when you try to talk to them, they really think they're doing a good thing for humanity, and they're, I don't know if they're altruistic, but I mean, they really are trying to be of benefit.
Sure.
And so when you start to challenge one of these things, that's a huge, because they feel that we're the ones who are hindering.
Christianity is the biggest impediment to world peace that they're...
And so it's really hard, but we're not battling against that person, flesh and blood. It's these things that are going on in the spiritual realm.
And that's right here, 2 Corinthians 10. That the weapons of our warfare.
Now that means there's weapons. And this so I wanted to also bring in that the church has been almost exclusively pacified. That there is no longer the recognition of the enmity that exists. It is a hostility that expressed itself first in the first dysfunctional family. One brother kills another brother.
You know, the word that jumped out to me as I listened to that was should.
Yes,
because every activist envisions the way things should be different than they are now. On what basis?
Exactly. Presupposition.
Yeah.
That's exactly. Why.
If there is no objective reality and there's no absolute truth, why should anything be any different than it is?
And why are you upset with me because I want to be different?
Precisely.
I'm just expressing my biochemistry just like you.
We're not being radical enough, that's the problem, because the drift has moved further, because they push the extremes, not the...
Exactly.
Not just the normal, central, like most people, if you just talk to general people, they're really kind of middle of the road between politics and all kinds of stuff. They're really just normal people. But the activist mentality is to push out to the extremes. And the extremes are, they removed the base, they took away truth, because you can't, there's not any truth to stand on for them.
Well, so the only thing they truth have claims.
Is, and they've sort of been duped into this thing of, oh, this is the, this is what needs to happen, and this is going to make things everything better, and they see the problems in the world, but they can't, they've been duped into thinking that this is the only solution, and this is the thing that works. Without foundations, you can't even hardly, put in a truth claim because, that's what you think, but, my truth claim internal to me is now better than yours.
And one of the things about radicals, and they are more willing to be ultra-radical, is that as they push that boundary up, what's happening down here? It's like this claim that there is this big disparity between the rich and the poor. The rich are getting richer. Well, what's happening in reality is, yes, the rich are getting richer, but the poor are getting richer as well. But that gap between them is bigger. And so with ideas, the more radical we can be, the more we're we only need a few percentage changes down here.
That doesn't seem so radical anymore down there.
Right. It's, right. Make all that stuff normal.
We can't move it.
Right. And everybody else thinks, well, no, that's normal.
If we're thinking that, like down this, we might change a few people, but way out here, and art and music and politics and all of this stuff is just radicalized and weaponized, then this begins to change. If you ever speak truth to power, there is no truth, but that comes right out of here. Power is the objective. And any system now is the power, so it's up to these people who have been radicalized a little bit to then begin voting, become, then kind of, there's a middle group, the activists themselves, and then there's the general population.
Well, become the dominant
voice. The whole shift. And this is where
we largely have no concept of what our weapons even are, to go against these ideas, and what I'm hoping is to begin to introduce some of those. We have to, God has the best ideas ever. And yet they're not being expressed. We're not bringing the answers to the problems, real problems that people are having, both personally, almost our whole focus is personal. There's not to the environment, not the environmental factors that are producing those problems. Poverty has a reason. Widespread poverty has a reason. Those are not being addressed. Yes, we'll help you. We'll help you get a job. We'll maybe pay your rent for a month or two to help you get established. Mm-hmm. But we're not dealing with the issues that bring those things to bear on a larger scale. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of this. Would somebody look up Matthew 16 and Jude 3. So we talked about Genesis 3, that God himself set this hostility between light and darkness, between ignorance and knowledge, between good and evil. All of those things, he set that there is a conflict there. They have Jude 3?
Yeah. Beloved, while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you, exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith, which was once for all delivered to the saints.
Okay, contend. That's a strong word. That there is an aggression there. Some years ago, I started hearing about aggressive faith. And it most specifically applies to healing. But I've never heard anybody talk like that. And it is 2 Corinthians, weapons of our warfare. We are involved in a war. And it is against ideas. And we always have to maintain the foundation of love, of honor and respect, and showing our enemies, pray for our enemies, pray for those who despitefully use and persecute you. But we're in a war. Jesus has already won, and it's just now a matter of displaying that. So, Matthew 16 has got that.
Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ.
All right. So he said, "I will build my ecclesia," almost exclusively translated as church today, but better translated as assembly. When King James Bible was written, it was ordered from the king that ecclesia will be translated as church, because it has a different connotation as the structure, the leadership, all that stuff, versus assembly, which is all the believers. There's a different connotation attached to it, and we wanted the emphasis to be on the structure, not the people. And in Roman times, the ecclesia, when the Romans took over a certain area, they would gather out respectable people from the community, called out and assembled, is literally what that word ecclesia means, gather them together. When Rome issued new rules, regulations, that kind of stuff, it was sent to the ecclesia, and it was the job of the ecclesia to translate them into their local environment. They couldn't change them, and they couldn't ignore them, but they could adapt them to those people. Some things wouldn't fit in some areas, but they could adjust them. And that's Jesus, and first off, who initiated this whole conversation? In verse 20, Jesus asked them. So he initiated this whole thing. And he said, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail. So are gates an offensive or defensive weapon?
Defense.
So who's on the offense?
We are.
The church is. Through the weapons of our warfare, through the mind of Christ, through access to solutions to problems that are plaguing people all over the world, contending for the faith, because there is a hostility there. And Jesus won on the cross. Rose from the dead as King of Kings and Lord, ascended, sat in the throne as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. It's done. Romans 1, or Revelation 1:5 says, he is the ruler of the kings of the earth. He's already there. It's already done. And so we carry this out to deal with the book Greg Bonson wrote, Pushing the Antithesis. We are aggressively moving forward with the kingdom of God. Instead of holding up in buildings, and which is a, we need that. But there's a piece that's missing out there. And it's evangelism is just a small part of it. Making disciples is what the Great Commission says, making disciples of all nations. That's where we take this. And we use these things to partly understanding who our enemy is. And that changes through time. 1,000 years ago, the issues of faith weren't like what we deal with today. They have to be adapted to the local times. We don't change the gospel. We don't change the standards, but it has to be adapted to the people that we're dealing with. You're going to deal with different people than you're going to deal with. But yet it's the same message, same King, same Holy Spirit, same directives that we get to bring to a lost and dying world. So, so I'm done with presuppositional apologetics. Now go and start, and I gave you this so you could read. This is, and I really admire how you have your message all laid out. I can't do that. And I can't read it very well. Well, so, yeah. This is fairly self-contained. And when I was putting together and I was reading it, because this comes, putting all this stuff in a book, and this comes right out of the book, but I've already put together on classical. And I was reading through this, and I wrote this like 10 months ago. Wow, this is good stuff. Who wrote this? I'm not sure I could do this again. But you can take it and read through it, and we'll go through questions. And as you have these, you can maybe come up with some questions on here. But I'm going to start with these four basic laws of acquiring human knowledge. And they're regularly attacked, and if any of these are compromised, it opens up all kinds of absurd possibilities. And these are the ones that, and as you're listening in the world, listen for how these are broken down. How are we doing?
We're good.
Okay.